Accession number 10295, Reel 5.
Delenn, Reel 5.
Yeah, as far as the powers that be were concerned, it wouldn't help morale at all to tell everybody what damage had actually been done. So we were blissfully ignorant of anything, you know, that happened that particular day. Although I do believe that there was a hell of a lot of heroes, but they were never mentioned. So, as far as we were concerned, the war had started. Then our job then was to, or not our job, particularly the CO's job then, was to distribute his men and guns to various locations on the island and up and down the country. Again, I'm fortunate in that I was with HQ. I was also the CO's bugler, which meant I carried the silver bugle. It was an honour I'd always wanted, you know, and I got it, but unfortunately there's a war on. And the CO then, once this had, war had been declared, anywhere he went, when he was on duty, I had to be with him, as had his bodyguard. He had two men as bodyguard, Charlie Blees and Ozzy Chamberlain. They were his bodyguard, big, tough, rough lads. So for the first 2 or 3 days, I stuck with him as his bugler, but it was boring. There was nothing happening. We dug bloody great pits in the ground and covered them over with wooden beams. And then a fortnight later, they'd collapse and we'd have to dig them again. And then we had to go down to Changi Jail. And just outside Changi Jail, we dug trenches and we camouflaged them. And then the rain filled them in, the seawater filled them in. And then an order was issued that in future, no trenches were to be built on Singapore because seawater would come in and it would cause a contamination of mosquitoes. So we weren't allowed to dig trenches. But you could build sandbags, you know, make a defence of sandbags, which was, to us, it was no use. You couldn't fight with sandbags in front of you. So there was no way at all that we was prepared in any way for a war. As far as we was concerned, it was just another Palestine, another, you know, bit of fun. So, as I say, the battalion was split up into various sections, naval base, etc., etc. And then we were sent. Yeah, we were sent up to Mersing. Because none of us had had a holiday for, I think it was 3 years, 4 years. So they sent us to Mersing for a change of air. And for a fortnight, as far as we was concerned, there was no war on. We just went and bathed and got pissed up and really enjoyed ourselves for a fortnight. And then come back into Singapore again, and we'd been told then what had happened up at the top, that the Japanese had landed up in Alastair. And at Singora. And the lads who took the brunt of that, and they never ever got any glory, but they should have done, was the Leicesters, the East Surreys, and the Argylls. They each went in with approximately 1,000 men, got 3,000 men there. And at the end of Singapore, when Singapore fell, there wasn't 500 men between them. There were three complete battalions, completely wiped out. And if you look at the paperwork now, you don't find them mentioned in any of the paperwork. They were put down as the British Battalion because they were so embarrassed about it. The powers that be were everything to cover up, to give morale, or supposed to be giving morale. But it wasn't. It was a load of bunking. Well, we then, in Singapore, the Manchester Regiment, we had to be content with just sitting and waiting. We built our own defences on the beaches, where we were permitted to, because the beaches of Singapore, east and west, were owned by Japanese. So there was no way you could build any defences, you know, on there. If you wanted to dig on the beach, you had to get permission from the Japanese consulate. and the Japanese consul wouldn't let you. But when the war started, there was no Japanese consul, but they still, it was still Japanese property. And the British would not allow us to do it because they say it was Japanese property and we'll have to pay reparations afterwards. So you can't damage it. So it was that the whole of the East Coast, we'd gone out and we'd put what we call boat obstacles. 20 to 25 foot lengths of tree were formed into like a triangle. And then the others going the other way. So it formed like an obstacle. And this was covered in in barbed wire. And then we had to tow that out to sea and drop it. The furthest we could take it was about 20 foot, 25 foot out to sea. So that the boats, any boats coming, would get caught up on it, assuming that they came on that type of boat. But when it was low tide, you could see the obstacles there. Now, all along the coast, every, oh, what would you say, 200 yards, 300 yards, there was a machine gun post, concrete pillbox. And these were occupied by one of our companies, A Company or B Company. And then the peak of the East Coast, above Changi, was B Company, B Supply Company. So you got H Company at the bottom end, the B Company at the top end. And from there you supplied all the way around. Now, oh, when would it be? Early January. The Japanese found out that we were up in this top corner. All our supplies were there. And they decided they'd bomb that particular spot. And they came down, I think with about three or four planes, and they give it hell. They really blasted it. We only lost about five men on that. And that was the first initiation that we had into actually being in action. And my job then was, at this particular time, was just general dog body. I'd got my own machine gun. I was number one gun. I got my own machine gun. I'd got three men. I got a driver. And if ever anybody wanted a relief, we were shot out to take their place and relief for whatever time they wanted, a day, 2 days. So that if, we'll say over on the east, on the naval base, there's they'd been in action, not in action, but in action stations for, we'll say, a week without rest. And we'd go in and relieve each particular team to give them a chance to go and have a break. Well, on this particular day anyway, I'd been out with a team. We'd been out with a team to go and relieve at A Company. I think it was on the naval base. But my driver, for some reason or other, I don't know why, but for some reason or other, he thought we was wanted at Bukit Timah. So I took it for granted that he knew where I was going. He was taking me for granted that I knew where I was going, so we got in the truck and we peeled up. And we had the gun on its tripod mounting on the back of the 1500 weight. And we got halfway through, we just got to where the surrender was signed, Ford's factory. And I turned around to the driver, I said, where the bloody hell are we going? So he said, we go to the naval base. I said, no, we did the naval base. We've been there. I said, we're supposed to go to Bukit Timah. So with an argument between us, finishing up, I was in charge. Even though I wasn't an NCO, I was in charge. It was my gun. I'm going to Bukit Timah. So we turn around, starts coming back. And we just got, it's hard for you to imagine, but for us, it's imprinted on the memory. You've got the Ford's factory where the deed was signed. You've got the main Bukit Timah Road coming down, and across it is the main railway line. And as we come under the bridge to go towards Bukit Timah, we could hear some piling going on. I mean, there was piling going on, but this was close. So the driver kicked in, pulled in to the side of the road, and we looked. And along the railway bank, there's no trains running then, of course. Along the railway bank, there's odd figures coming running down. Well, we'd always been taught that you don't run on the skyline. You don't show yourself on the skyline. You keep down below. And these lads were running along the skyline. And as we watched, we could see them being killed off, one, two, three, you know, and dropping off. So there was no more. We just saw three or four shot, and then everything vanished. So we slung the gun round and started firing in that direction, you know. And all it did was draw their fire. They then started throwing mortars at us, two-inch mortars. So we knew then it was Japanese. So hightailed it back out. And get back to our camp at 10th Milestone, which is the other side of Singapore. And the quartermaster, Jerry Quinn, he said, I want you to go now to Bukit Timah. We told him what had happened, and he said, there's nothing we can do about it. He said, I want you to go to Bukit Timah. I said, but the Japs are, you know, coming on there. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. They're being held. Nothing to worry about. Go to Bukit Timah. I want you to take Jimmy Byers with you. That was a young school teacher, a militiaman. Go to there, and you'll be met, ask for, I've forgotten his name now. I think it was Dali, something like that. But this officer we had to ask for. And our job when we got there was to pick up a Chinese driver. And the Chinese driver had a flat truck with just the sides on. And resting across the sides was either four or five planks. And our job was to pick up these lads from the Cambridge Regiment who had just been brought in from England, sit them on the back of the trucks and take them for a drive round Singapore. Now, you know, in the middle of a bloody war, we're machine gunners, we're gritted and we're ready. And our job was to be chauffeur to a pile of rookies, because they were rookies. Most of them were white skinned. We had to take them around Singapore and say, well, that's the new world, that's the great world, that's the happy world, that's so-and-so, that's the football ground. And then take them back to Bukit Timah. And I thought, well, you know, what the hell? But as we was going back to Bukit Timah, you shoot off the main road to go up the road leading to Bukit Timah racetrack. And as we turn into the going like that, the Chinese driver tried to turn, and he put his foot on the clutch to change gear. And the clutch pedal wouldn't come back up, so he got no power. And as he's slithering like that, a naval car came tearing down, and it was doing about 90, and he slammed into us. He tippled our truck straight over. And the lads, all the lads in the naval car, I think they were all dead. Must have been. And I got up waving my bloody pistol round. I'd got a revolver. And I thought the bloody Japs had attacked us. And I was waving the pistol round and telling the lads, come on, get on your feet, get on your feet. And some officer came over. And he said to me, you can put the gun down, lad. The war's over. You know, your war's over, something like that. All the lads that were in the truck had scattered. They run into the Bukit Timah. And I'm left there with Jimmy Byers, who couldn't walk, on a truck, no Chinese driver. So an ambulance, they sent an ambulance down, which took Jimmy and the lads out of the car. And I was told then to sit down and write a report about a traffic accident and to make a report to the quartermaster. And then I was to go down to the police station and give them a description of the Chinese driver that had been driving. You know, and then the police then had to go around looking for this Chinese driver. You know, and there's a bloody war on.
What date was this approximately?
Six, seventh, 8th February. The Japs had landed on the 9th. Well, officially landed on the 9th.
Who had been the soldiers on the skyline who were being shot?
They were from the... we went out actually and picked them up. Picked the bodies up. There was two out of the Norfolks. One was... No, I can't think of his name now. No, there's two out of the Norfolks, and one was out of the Leicesters. And we buried them just at the side of the bridge. We dug a shallow pit and dropped the three in and then covered them over and left the rifle there and the tin helmet. We took the dog tags, of course, and handed them in to our quartermaster. What he did with them, I don't know.
So this was the 18th Division, was it? Who'd...
It was the 18th Division. They'd come in onto the island... What, 18th of January? 19th of January? Something like that. They'd brought him on the island and... Well, it was bloody stupid because there was nothing... There was no... They'd no equipment, they'd nothing. They had a lot of gloves. I remember that vividly. They had a lot of these, you know, these gloves that dispatch riders wear with a wide gauntlet.
Heavy gloves.
No, for motorbikes. Them. He had loads and loads of them. But no rifles, no ammunition out like that. Some of them had been banged straight up country. I mean, the 118 artillery. That's what we were short of, was artillerymen. And the 118 had been banged straight up country without any initiation. I think the Cambridges stayed in Singapore. The Norfolks, one or two of their companies or battalions went up. But by and large, the majority of English troops, apart from the Leicesters, the East Surreys, the Argylls, the Gordons, apart from them, I think most of the English soldiers, infantrymen that is, stayed back in Singapore. And most of the Australian infantry stayed in Singapore.
What's that?
Well, I was going to say the battles in coming down Malaya were mostly, I would think anyway, it was mostly Indian soldiers, corps men, you know, RAOC, RAMC, artillerymen, stuff like that. They were the ones that caught the brunt of it.
What's happened to you personally after this accident?
After the accident, I went out on one or two occasions where we wasn't supposed to go out. It had got to the stage there where discipline was... It was still discipline, but it was only discipline if they could see you. So if you got out of the way, nobody bothered. So we had one particular... The trick or the habit in those days was you had a 1500 weight truck, and where the Japanese used to fly a pennant with a red ball in it, we used to fly our own pennant. Mine was a skull and crossbones, just an ordinary white cloth, and you drew a skull and crossbones on it and you flew it, and that was yours. So you used to go out and look for it, look for trouble, you know, look for Japanese, until... Oh, we'd fired many a time from over across the causeway. We knew the Japs were there. They'd been there from the beginning of February. And we'd fire across the water at them, just hopefully. Because in the distance over on Johor's side was the Johor's, the Sultan of Johor's palace. And in the grounds of that was this bloody great blimp. You know, the old thing they used to use in the 1418 war, observation balloon. And that was there. And blokes used to stay many and many a time. They'd be firing up at that thing. It's too far away to hit. You know. And the guy, the Japanese, there was two of them actually, used to stand up there and give observations as to where this, that and the other was, you know, on the island. And then the planes would come in and bomb at their discretion. On the... Japs landed on the 9th. And on the 10th of February, we'd fell back, the HQ had fallen back to a school in the centre, more or less centre of Singapore. The street was, oh, it was a bloody racket. There's bombs going off, bullets and everything, every kind of noise you can imagine was going off. And down the street from us was a row of houses that had been bombed and bombed again, and just two or three structures still standing. As I say, we was in the schoolroom, and our job was just to wait until we got a call out to go on different jobs. And while I was waiting there, we were taking pot shots at planes with Bren guns and Sten guns or whatever we had. You know, we was firing at planes. And then this particular morning, as I say, the plane came down, dived, and as he dived, he dropped a stick, and you could watch him literally watch him falling, only singly, you know, not a blanket lot. And one fell and hit the end of the terrace houses, the two that were remaining standing. And in there we knew was the artillery, you know, observation team or whatever. And there's me, Charlie Blease, I think it was Bulger Bailey, about four or five of us anyway. We run down there and there's blokes shouting, help, help. You know, pulled all the dunes away. and it was three men from the 118 Field Regiment, Royal Artillery. And we was really, fingers were bloody sore, pulling them out, you know. Grabbed them out, gave them a duster, took them down to the school, fed them some bully beef and biscuits, gave them a cup of tea. You know, let them sponge themselves off. And then said to them, do you know, they didn't even say thank you. The names, I still remember the names. One was Dougie Sponsmith. One was Bert Craddock. And the other was Dougie Swan. All in 118 Field Regiment. I met them later, actually, in the prison camp, but they never even said thank you. It was everything was taken for granted. Then, oh, the next job after that. Oh, that's it, the CO. I think it was the CO. Suddenly remembered that up in 10th Milestone, where we'd been, all the battalion, whatever was left of the battalion silver, that's the officer's mess silver, had been left up there. Because we'd done a quick evacuation. So he'd arranged for, I think it must have been about 15 or 20 labourers, to go into where our camp was. And they dug a bloody great pit. I'd say about, it was roughly 20, 30 feet square. And 10, 12 feet deep. And into this, we put all what was left of the battalion silver. That's the officer's mess stuff. Because they still retain the officer's mess dignitary dinners and stuff like this, even in the jungle. And that was put in there. And my bugle, my silver bugle. You know, that was the last time I saw it actually went in that box. We also put in there the roll, the payroll and all the records. And they were all put in either greaseproof paper or, it wasn't polythene then, like a rubbery sheet. Everything was covered up and put in this. And then they filled it all in. Everything had to be filled in then, bulldozed over and left. And then we had to go to the officer's mess and destroy all the liquid, all the liquor. And I never ever knew that we had so much bloody liquor on the camp. We were rationed to, I think it was 2 pints of beer or 3 pints of beer a day. And yet this place was swimming in spirits. And our job was then to destroy all this in case the Japs got it. Because they said that it would only get them drunk and they'd start, be more aggressive fighters or whatever. So we had to destroy all that. And then get back to Singapore. Now, on the way back to Singapore, we had, you always carried a DR, a dispatch rider in front, so that if anything happened to you, he could go on and tell him what had happened. And unfortunately, the dispatch rider was travelling a little bit too far in front of us, and a little bit too fast for his own good, because they put a tripwire across the road, the 5th Columnist, and he tippled out of off his bike. And when we got up to him, I've forgotten what his name was now. But we got up to him, the tripwire had done more damage than what the actual fall had. Because as he'd fallen, the wire had ripped, and it had ripped all the skin from the side of his leg. All the side of one leg. The wire itself was so fine, it had ripped the bloody lot off, you know. And he was a terrible mess. And of course, we took him back, and once we got back then, as I say, the Japanese had then landed. That was the 9th of February, and from then on, it was really hectic. It was 4 days of sheer hell and misery, because you've got your bombers going over the bloody top, you've got your 5th Columnists were absolutely terrible. It was terrible with the Malays and the Chinese and a lot of Indians. So much so that an order was given that, not an order, an instruction was given, that if anybody saw anything that looked suspicious, they should kill immediately. And that was that the 5th Columnists were so blatant, they used to wear a letter F. It would either be a letter F on the motor car, it'd be a letter F interwoven into the jumpers. There'd be a letter F somewhere on them to indicate to others that they were all in the same group. And this was the order that was passing from High Command. But they hadn't told us that the fire service wore a blue jumper, with the Redder into Wilton. The Federated Malay States volunteers, they wore the letter. Registration on the motor vehicles had the letter F included. All these things, you know, and it confused everybody. And this particular morning, as I say, the Japs had landed at the top and everybody was going down south. I mean, the island's only, what, 12 mile, 15 mile across, but they're gradually moving down. And on this particular morning, we stood about, we were waiting for instructions, and a car came down, a little old, more like an Austin Ruby. And as it came down, somebody shouted, halt, because the registration on it was FM something or other. Of course, the Chinese, he was driving it, didn't hear him. His engine was too loud or something. And he carried on driving. The lad next to me was Bulger Bailey. And he dropped down, the same man who'd shot Higgins in Palestine, dropped down on one knee, put his rifle up and let a shot go after it. I don't know whether he meant to do any damage or not, whether he just fired in anger or just to let a shot off or what. But within seconds, the car stopped. And the lad watched, you know, and the Chinese lad got out. And he moved his seat, started jiggling about with the seat. Then he went to the other side. And then he came back, and it was the most horrid sight you see. He was crying, literally. Sheer hopelessness was on his face. He was really in tears. Why? 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 This was the question he kept asking. And of course, we, not knowing what the hell, you know, what the hell's up with you? What are you on about? What do you want? Where are you going? You know, and we're at him. Why? And at finishing up, two of the lads, Charlie Blees and one of the others, went down to his car to have a look. And what happened, Bulger's bullet had gone through the back of the car, through the lad's wife, and through the baby that she'd got on her, you know, she was nursing. Just through the two of them, and out again through the front window. And that's why he was asking, why? You know, why are you killing us? What's it all about? You know, and it, to me, it was a real sad point in the operation, that. But from there, then...
Going back to the 5th Colonists, can you tell me what activity they were carrying out?
Oh, every form of activity you can imagine. Sugar in your petrol tanks, roadblocks, dropping trees, flashing lights at night time. In the jungle, they'd cut spaces to give an arrow indication. Wherever we had an observation post, a machine gun post, an artillery gun, whatever, they would fix the, you know, these palm trees, you know, the long leaves of the palm trees. They would fit them together, pointing in the direction of where we